Roll now.
Blog Talk Radio.
America is essentially a dream. It is a dream of a land where men of all races, of all nationalities, and of all creeds can live together as brothers. The substance of the dream is expressed in these profound words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One of the first things we notice in this dream is its amazing universalism. It does not say some men, but it says all men. It doesn't say all white men, but it says all men, which includes black men. It doesn't say all Gentiles, but it says all men, which includes Jews. It doesn't say all Protestants, but it says all men, which includes Catholics. That is something else that we notice in this dream, which is one of the things that distinguishes democracy and our form of government with other totalitarian systems. It says that there are certain basic rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. In order to discover where they came from, it is necessary to move back behind the dim mist of eternity. They are God-given. Very seldom. Very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent, and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. While the American dream reminds us that every man is the heir of a legacy of dignity. Yet ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, America has been, to use a big word that the psychologists and the psychiatrists use, a schizophrenic personality. Thank you for your time. On the one hand, she has proudly professed the noble principles of democracy, and on the other hand, she has proudly practiced, or she has sadly practiced, the very opposite of those principles. Indeed, slavery and segregation have always been strange paradoxes in a nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. So often, America has trampled over the dream. So often, America has scarred this noble dream. We look and see certain states saying they will never comply with the law of the land. In doing this, America is scarring the dream. We notice people who merely want to be free being brutalized, homes being bombed, churches being bombed. This is a way of scarring the American dream. We notice people who merely want to exercise that citizenship right, being thrown into jail. This is a way of starring the dream. We can hear the voice of a little Emmett Till crying from the rushing waters of Mississippi. This is a way of starring the dream. And so the Negro is still trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. And so often he has been pushed out of the glittering sunlight of life's July and left standing in the piercing chill of an alpine November. This is scarring the American dream. May I say to you, as has been said so eloquently all the afternoon, this dream is being scarred not only in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and all of the southern states, but it is being scarred in New York, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and I imagine even in California. The fact is that the Negro all over America is still the last tide in the first five, and he still can't live where he wants to live and where his money can get him to live. But today, more than ever before, America is challenged to bring this noble dream into reality. The shape of the world today does not afford us the luxury of an anemic democracy. And the price that the United States must pay for the continued exploitation of the Negro and other minority groups is the price of its own destruction. People are looking over to the United States today and they're wondering what we're doing about this problem. They're looking over from Asia and Africa. For years, most of these people have been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated, and humiliated by some foreign power. Today, they are gaining their independence. More than 1,600,000,000 of the former 1,800,000,000 colonial subjects have their independence today. And they are saying in no uncertain terms that racism and colonialism must go. The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. We must act now before it is too late. It is quite but urgently true that if America is to remain a first-class nation, she can no longer have second-class citizens. To say that we must not solve this problem merely to meet the communist challenge. We must not seek to solve this problem merely to appeal to Asian and African peoples. This problem must be solved in the United States because segregation and discrimination are morally wrong. It must be solved because segregation relegates persons to the status of things and stands against all of the noble principles of our Judeo-Christian heritage. It must be solved not merely because it is diplomatically expedient, but because it is morally compelling. This must be said all over the world. And I would say that there are some things that we must continue to do in order to make the American dream a reality and save our nation in this hour. I would like to mention them as briefly as possible and elaborate on them briefly. First, in order to make the American dream a reality, we must seek to make the world dream a reality, and therefore we must begin with a world perspective. You see, the world in which we live is geographically one. Now we are challenged to make it spiritually one. Now, it is true that the geographical oneness of this age in which we live came into being to a large extent through man's scientific ingenuity. Man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in change. Yes, we've been able to carve highways through the stratosphere. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took days. Bob Hope has described this new jet age in which we live, and I think he's given an adequate description. He said it is an age in which it is possible to take a nonstop flight from Los Angeles to New York, and if on taking off in Los Angeles, you develop hiccups, you will hick in Los Angeles and cup in New York City. You know, it is possible because of the time difference to take a flight from Tokyo, Japan on Sunday morning and arrive in Seattle, Washington on the preceding Saturday night. And when your friends meet you at the airport and ask when you left Tokyo, you will have to say, I left tomorrow. This is the kind of world in which we live. This is a bit humorous, but I'm trying to laugh a basic fact in all of it, and it is simply this. Through our scientific genius, we've made of the world a neighborhood. And now, through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make of it a brotherhood. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. And it simply means that every nation must be concerned about every other nation. Every individual must be concerned about every other individual. Someone said, and I turn it over to that great country known as India. I never will forget the experience of talking with and meeting with the great leaders of India, meeting people in the cities and the villages all over that country. Noble and marvelous experience. And I say to you this afternoon, that are those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes millions of people sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Calcutta, more than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population of 400 million people, more than 365 million make an annual income of less than $60 a year? Most of these people have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I know disease conditions, something within me cried out, we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no. Destiny of India and the destiny of every other nation is tied up with the destiny of the United States, and the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India. And I started thinking about the fact right here in America we spend more than $1 million a day to store surplus food, and I found myself saying, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the wrinkled stomachs of the hundreds and millions of people who go to their hunger. Maybe we've spent far too much of our money in the United States establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. As long as there is extreme poverty in this world, no man can be totally rich even if he has $1 billion. As long as disease is rampant and millions of people cannot expect to live more than 28 or 30 years, no one can be totally healthy even if he just got a checkup in the finest clinic of the nation. Strangely enough, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. 140 years ago and to place it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Then he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. This is the meaning of having a world perspective. If we are to realize the American dream, the other point is that we must get rid of the notion once and for all that there are superior and inferior races. We must make it clear all over this land and all over the world that a doctrine of white supremacy has no basis in anthropology, has no basis in scientific thinking, and has no basis in morality. Now, you know, people used to argue, this thing still gets around, people used to argue that the Negro was inferior by nature. And they went back in the Bible and they would get up certain passages in the Bible. It's a strange thing how people would use religion often to justify their prejudices. And they would go back in the Bible. And they would say, now the Negro is inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. You know, there was a great philosopher back in Greek philosophy by the name of Aristotle who did a great deal to set up formal logic. And he would have what was known as a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so one brother, during the days of slavery, wanted to justify slavery, and he had set his argument up on the framework of Aristotle's thinking. He could say, now, all men are made in the image of God. Then came his minor premise, God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro, therefore the Negro is not a man. This is the kind of reason that prevailed. But today, we don't hear these arguments too much. They argue now on more cultural and subtle sociological grounds. The Negro is not culturally ready for integration. And if you integrate schools and if you integrate too much, the Negro will pull the white race back a generation. And then they go on to say, you know, that the Negro is inherently criminal and all of these things. Now, these people never say to us that many of these problems, the problems of urban dislocation and that poverty, ignorance, and disease breed crime, whatever the racial group may be, that these conditions are environmental and not racial. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation and discrimination as an argument for the continuation of it. Seems to do it to get rid of it. Over this nation, we must get rid of the notion once and for all if we want to realize the dream that there are superior and inferior races. Now, that is the final point that we must, final thing that we must do in order to realize the American dream. We must continue to engage in creative protest to break down the barriers of segregation and discrimination. Now, I know that there are those people who are the victims of some strange illusions. And they don't believe in the necessity for continued protest. One illusion is a myth of time. They say, just wait and don't push things and be patient and pray and time will work this problem out. You've heard that, I'm sure. These people fail to realize that time is neutral. And it can be used positively or negatively. We've seen this myth at work in the South. The fact is that the segregationist points have made a much more effective use of time than some other sources of goodwill, even the federal government. And I am convinced that we may have to repent not only for the blatant vitriolic words of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Talking about time. We must get rid of the notion that human progress rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. We must come to see that human progress is never inevitable. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals, and without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. We must make it clear that the time to do right is now, and that the time is always right to do right. Now, the other illusion is the myth of educational determinism, as I call it. You've heard these people say, now you've got to change the hearts of men, that's the only way you can solve it, and I guess that's true. Solve it ultimately, and they say, it takes education to solve this problem. It's an educational process, and therefore it can't be done through legislation. It can't be done through judicial decrees. It can't be done through executive orders by the President of the United States. It must be done through education. Now, I think it's right that education must work in this whole area, but it is both education and legislation, not either legislation or education. Now, it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. I guess it is true that the law can't make a man love me. Religion and education must do that. But the law can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important too. So it means that we must push on in legislation, in the North and in the South. Every state should have fair employment practice commission so that there would be no discrimination in this area. Every state needs a fair housing law so that it would be made clear that there can be no discrimination in housing publicly or privately, and that even real estate people who will try to perpetuate this will have to stand before the bar of justice. This must be done all over the United States. Then we must continue to delve deeper into the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. There is something about this method that has power. And I know that there are those who will ridicule it occasionally, but it has worked miracles in the South. It has morality with it because it gives us the opportunity to work to secure moral ends through moral means. This is the morality of it. But it has certain practical consequences. It exposes the moral defenses of the opponent, somehow weakens his morale, and all at the same time it is working on his conscience. It disarms him, and he just doesn't know what to do with it. If he puts you in jail, that's all right. If he doesn't put you in jail, fine. If he beats you up, that's all right. If he doesn't beat you up, that's all right. If he tries to kill you, all right, you develop the quiet courage of dying if necessary without killing. If he tries to threaten you, all right, if he doesn't. That is something about it which causes the opponent not to know what to do. Now, he would know what to do with violence. He could call out the state militia. He could call out the National Guard and kill hundreds and hundreds of innocent people and argue that they are inciting a riot. They know how to handle violence, but they prove over and over again that they don't know how to handle nonviolence because they throw people. They try to handle it by throwing us in jail. But what happens? We go into the jails of Jackson, Mississippi, and transform these jails from dungeons of shame to havens of freedom and human dignity. I believe firmly that this is the way. Now, that is another aspect of it, about this method. And people ask me about it all the time. What do you mean when you tell us to love these people who are beating on us and burning our houses and kicking our children around. What in the world do you mean when you say love such people? And I always have to stop and try to define the meaning of love in this area. And interestingly enough, Greek philosophy comes to our aid at this point. There are three words in the Greek language for love. One of them is the word eros. Now, eros is a sort of aesthetic love. The philosopher Plato talks about it a great deal in his dialogues, the yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. It has come to us to mean a sort of romantic love, and so we all know about eros. We've experienced it. We've read about it in the beauties of literature. In a sense, Edgar Allan Poe was talking about eros when he talked about his beautiful Annabel Lee with a love surrounded by the halo of eternity. In a sense, Shakespeare was talking about eros when he said, love is not love, but alters whence alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken. It is a star to ever wandering bark. You know, I can remember that because I used to quote it to my wife when we were coding. That's eros. That's eros. Then the Greek language talks about phileo, which is another level of love. It is an intimate affection between personal friends. On this level, we love because we are love. We love people that we like. This is friendship. Then the Greek language has another word called agape. Agape is more than romantic love. Agape is more than friendship. Agape is not something affectionate. Agape is understanding, created, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Theologians would say that it is the love of God operating in the human heart. When one rises to love on this level, he loves men not because he likes them, but he loves every man because God loves him. He goes on with that. And so he rises to the level of hating the system rather than the individual who is caught up in that system. He loves the person and hates the evil deed. And I think this is what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. And I'm happy that he didn't say, like your enemies, because it's pretty difficult to like some people. It's difficult to like people bombing your home and threatening your children and kicking you about. But Jesus says, love them, and love is greater than like. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. And somehow, more and more I've come to believe this. Yes. This is the way that we will get out of this dark night of oppression and make of this nation a better nation. It means that we can stand up and allow the opposition to know that we will not accept injustice. Yes. We will stand up against it with our lives, but we will never stoop down to the level of violence and hatred. And we will come to that point when we will be able to convince him that a new world is emerging. I tell you this evening that it will give us the right attitude. I know sometimes how discontent we get, and we have a right to get discontent, and how frustrated we get in the process sometimes. But I submit to you this evening that this way of nonviolence will help us not to seek to rise from a position of disadvantage to one of advantage, thus subverting justice. We will not substitute one tyranny for another. For black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. I am convinced this afternoon that God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race and the creation of a society. I believe with this method and this approach, we will be able to win. And finally, as we struggle, we do not struggle alone. It's dark sometimes. It's difficult, particularly for those who are struggling in the deep south, facing all of the violence and all of the suffering. That is something that controls us along the way. We are convinced that our cause is right. I return to Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, not in despair, not in bitterness. I return knowing that we are moving into a bright day of freedom. We, through our struggles, through our suffering, through our sacrifice, will be able to achieve. achieve the American dream, this would be the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank Almighty, we are free at last. They told us we wouldn't get here. And there were those who said that we would get here only over their dead bodies.
Well, all
the world today knows that we are here and we are standing before the forces of power in the state of Alabama saying we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
To build a great temple.
building of the temple was considered to be the most significant thing facing the Hebrew people, and the king was expected to bring this into being. David had the desire. He started. And then we come to that passage over in the 8th chapter of 1 Kings, which reads that it was in the heart of David, my father, to build an house for the name of the Lord God of Israel. And the Lord said unto David, my father, whereas it was in thine heart to build an house unto my name, thou didst well that it was within thine heart. That's really what I want to talk about this morning. It is well that it was within thine heart. As if to say, David, you will not be able to finish the temple. You will not be able to build it. But I just want to bless you because it was within thine heart. Your dream will not be fulfilled. The majestic hopes that guided your days will not be carried out in terms of an actual temple coming into being that you were able to build. But I bless you, David, because it was within thine heart. You had the desire to do it. You had the intention to do it. You tried to do it. You started to do it. And I bless you for having the desire and the intention in your heart. It is well that it was within thine heart. So many of us in life start out building temples, temples of character, temples of justice, temples of peace. So often we don't finish them. Because life is like a Schubert's unfinished symphony. At so many points we start, we try. We set out to build our various temples. And I guess one of the great agonies of life is that we are constantly trying to finish that which is unfinishable. We are commanded to do that. And so we, like David, find ourselves in so many instances having to face the fact that our dreams are not fulfilled. Now let us notice first that life is a continual story of shattered dreams. Mahatma Gandhi labored for years and years for the independence of his people through a powerful nonviolent revolution. He was able to win that independence for years. The Indian people have been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated and humiliated by foreign powers, and Gandhi struggled against it. He struggled to unite his own people, and nothing was greater in his mind than to have India as one great united country moving toward a higher destiny. This was his dream. But Gandhi had to face the fact that he was assassinated and died with a broken heart, because that nation that he wanted to unite ended up being divided between India and Pakistan as a result of the conflict between the Hindus and the Muslims. Life is a long, continual story of setting out to build a great temple and not being able to finish it. Woodrow Wilson dreamed the dream of a League of Nations. He died before the promise was delivered. The Apostle Paul talked one day about wanting to go to Spain. It was Paul's greatest dream, to go to Spain, to carry the gospel there. Paul never got to Spain. He ended up in a prison cell in Rome. This is the story of life. So many of our forebears used to sing about freedom. They dreamed of the day that they would be able to get out the bosom of slavery, the long night of injustice. They used to sing little songs. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows but Jesus. Thought about a better day as they dreamed that dream, and they would say, I'm so glad the trouble don't last always. By and by, I'm going to lay down my heavy load. And they used to sing it because of a powerful dream. So many died without having the dream fulfilled. And each of you this morning, in some way, is building some kind of temple. The struggle is always there. It gets discouraging sometimes. It gets very disenchanting sometimes. Some of us are trying to build a temple of peace. We speak out against war, we protest, but it seems that your head is going against a concrete wall. It seems to mean nothing. So often as you set out to build the temple of peace, you're left lonesome. You're left discouraged. You're left bewildered. Well, it is the story of life, and the thing that makes me happy is that I can hear the voice crying through the mist of time, saying, it may not come today or it may not come tomorrow, but it is well that it is within thine heart. It's well that you are trying. You may not see it. The dream may not be fulfilled, but it's just clear that you have a desire to bring it into reality. It's well that it's in thine heart. Thank God this morning that we do have hearts to put something meaningful in. Life is a continual story of shattered dreams. Now let me bring out another point. Whenever you set out to build the creative temple, whatever it may be, you must face the fact that there is a tension at the heart of the universe between good and evil. It's there. A tension at the heart of the universe between good and evil. Hinduism refers to this as a struggle between illusion and reality. Platonic philosophy used to refer to it as a tension between body and soul. Zoroastrianism, a religion of old, used to refer to it as a tension between the God of light and the God of darkness. Traditional Judaism and Christianity refer to it as a tension between God and Satan. Whatever you call it, that is a struggle in the universe between good and evil. Now, not only is that struggle struck out somewhere in the external forces of the universe, it's structured in our own lives. Psychologists have tried to grapple with it in their way, and so they say various things. Sigmund Freud used to say that this tension is a tension between what he called the id and the superego. But you know, some of us feel that it's a tension between God and man. And in every one of us this morning, there's a war going on. It's a civil war. I don't care who you are. I don't care where you live. There's a civil war going on in your life. Every time you set out to be good, there's something pulling on you, telling you to be evil. It's going on in your life. Every time you set out to love, something keeps pulling on you, trying to get you to hate. Every time you set out to be kind and say nice things about people, something is pulling on you to be jealous and envious and to spread evil gossip about them. There's a civil war going on. Every time you say that I'm not going to let this evil habit destroy me, something keeps pulling on you, saying, keep on doing it. That is a schizophrenia, as the psychologists or the psychiatrists would call it, going on within all of us. And there are times that all of us know somehow that there's a Mr. Hyde and a Dr. Jekyll in us. And we end up having to crowd with all that the Latin poet, I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do. We end up having to agree with Plato that the human personality is like a charioteer with two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in different directions. Or sometimes we even have to end up crying out with St. Augustine, as he said in his Confessions, Lord, make me pure, but not yet. We end up crying out with the Apostle Paul, the good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that I do. And we end up having to say with Gerda that there's enough stuff in me to make both a gentleman and a rogue. Tension at the heart of human nature. And whenever we set out to dream our dreams and to build our temples, we must be honest enough to recognize it. This brings me to the basic part of the text. In the final analysis, God does not judge us by the separate incidents or the separate mistakes that we make, but by the total bent of our lives. And the final analysis, God knows that his children are weak and they're frail. And the final analysis, what God requires is that your heart is right. Salvation isn't reaching the destination of absolute morality, but it's being in the process on the right road. There's a highway called Highway 80. I've marched on that highway from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery. But I never will forget my first experience with Highway 80. It was was driving with Coretta and Ralph and Juanita Abernathy to California. We drove from Montgomery all the way to Los Angeles on Highway 8. It drove all the way out to Los Angeles. And you know, being a good man, being a good woman, does not mean that you've arrived in Los Angeles. It simply means that you're on Highway 80. Maybe you haven't gotten as far as Selma, or maybe you haven't gotten as far as Meridian, Mississippi, or Monroe, Louisiana. That isn't the question. The question is whether you're on the right road. Salvation is being on the right road, not having reached the destination. Oh, we have to finally face the point that there is none good but the Father. But if you're on the right road, God has the power, and he has something called grace. And he puts you where you ought to be. Now, the terrible thing in life is to be trying to get to Los Angeles on Highway 78. That's when you're lost. That sheep was lost. Not merely because he was doing something wrong in that parable, but he was on the wrong road. And he didn't even know where he was going. He became so involved in what he was doing, nibbling sweet bread, and he got on the wrong road. Salvation is being sure that you're on the right road. It is well. That's what I like about it. And it was within my heart. Some weeks ago, somebody was saying something to me about a person that I have great, magnificent respect for. They were trying to say something that didn't sound too good about his character, something he was doing. And I said, number one, I don't believe it. Number two, even if he is, he's a good man because his heart is right. And in the final analysis, God isn't going to judge him by that little separate mistake that he's making because the bent of his life is right. The question I want to raise this morning with you, is your heart right? If the heart isn't right, fix it up today. Get God to fix it up. Get somebody to be able to say about you. You may not have reached the highest height. He may not have realized all of his dreams, but he tried. Isn't that a wonderful thing for somebody to say about you? He tried to be a good man. He tried to be a just man. He tried to be an honest man. His heart was in the right place. I can hear the voice saying, crying out through the eternities, I accept you. You are a recipient of my grace because it was in your heart. And it's so well that it was in my heart. I don't know this morning about you, but I can make a testimony. You don't need to go out this morning saying that Martin Luther King is a saint. Oh, no. I want you to know this morning that I'm a sinner like all of God's children, but I want to be a good man. I want to hear a voice saying to me one day, I get in and I bless you because you're trying. It is well that it was within our heart. What's in your heart this morning? You get your heart right.
This is a protest and a struggle against racism and injustice. And this is what we are working to eliminate in our organization and in our total struggle. I would also like to commend the outstanding athletes who have the courage and the kind of determination to make it clear that they will not participate in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City unless something is done about these terrible problems, these terrible evils and injustices. Freedom always demands sacrifice.
So the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration, that's their business. I'm afraid of them. And I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
We will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man to the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice.
They go talking about these little levels of progress that we see here and there, and they say, you know, you've made great progress. Aren't you satisfied? No, we are not satisfied. We will not be satisfied. As long as Negro boys and Negro girls are forced to live life without dignity and without respect, we will not be satisfied.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure. High and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What he's doing is using an adjective to describe something that's incidental about him, one of his incidental characteristics. So there's nothing else to it, just white. But when you get the white man over here in America and he says he's white, he means something else. You can listen to the sound of his voice when he says he's white. He means he's boss. That's right. That's what white means in this language. You know the expression free, white, and 21? He made that up. He said, you know, all of them mean the same. White means free, boss. He's up there. So that when he says he's white, he has a little different sound in his voice. And I know you know what I'm talking about. This was what I saw was missing in the Muslim world. They said they were white. It was incidental. White, black, brown, red, yellow. That's maybe different what color you are. And so this was the religion that I had accepted and had gone there to get a better knowledge of it. And but despite the fact that I saw that Islam was a religion of brotherhood, I also had to face reality. And when I get back into this American society, I'm not in a society that practices brotherhood. I'm in a society that might preach it on Sunday, but they don't practice it in, on no day, on any day. So since I can see that America itself is a society where there is no brotherhood, and that this society is controlled primarily by racists and segregationists, and it is, who use and who are in Washington, D.C., in positions of power, and from Washington, D.C., they exercise the same forms of brutal oppression against dark-skinned people in South and North Vietnam, or in the Congo, or in Cuba, or in any other place on this earth where they're trying to exploit and oppress. This is a society whose government doesn't hesitate to inflict the most brutal form of punishment and oppression upon dark-skinned people all over the world. To wit, right now, what's going on in and around Saigon and Hanoi and in the Congo and elsewhere. They are violent when their interests are at stake. But that, with all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be nonviolent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea. They're violent in Germany. They're violent in the South Pacific. They're violent in Cuba. They're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent. That's a shame, because we get tricked into being nonviolent. And when somebody stands up and talks like I just did, they say, well, he's advocating violence. Isn't that what they say? Every time you pick up your newspaper, you hear what one of these things has written into it, that I'm advocating violence. And I have never advocated any violence. I've only said that black people who are the victims of organized violence perpetrated upon us by the Klan, the Citizens Council, and many other forms, we should defend ourselves. And when I say that we should defend ourselves against the violence of others, they use their press skillfully to make the world think that I'm calling on violence here. And I wouldn't call on anybody to be violent without a cause. But I think the black man in this country, above and beyond people all over the world, it will be more justified when he stands up and starts to protect himself, no matter how many necks he has to